Tonight we are continuing our series, Eschatology and the Antichrist. This is part four of this series. And tonight I want to tackle a question that has to do with the date of the book of Revelation. So we're going to engage in a topic we don't often cover, New Testament introduction, which is part of a seminary education and deals with the authorship, the origin, the genre, and the critical issues respective of particular books of the Bible. The issue with preterism is, as you know, there are a number of popular writers, Ken Gentry among others, who make a large issue of the date of the book of Revelation, and so at some point in this series, this is never an issue we haven't addressed. I haven't addressed it any place yet. I do have an extensive appendix on it in my book, and if you want the references, go there, and I deal with that in some detail, and we'll cover that material tonight. So the theme, the date of the book of Revelation, and then the sub-point is a problem for preterists. Now, as I note on my first point, a theological position is only as strong as its weakest link. And the preterist interpretation of the doctrine of Antichrist and the beast is based upon the fact that John was supposedly given his apocalyptic vision before the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. Now, this allows preterists then to identify the beast of the book of Revelation with Nero, thereby limiting Antichrist to the series of heretics mentioned in John's epistles who will plague the church until the Lord's return. So, if you know the contemporary preterist position, and I want to just define the term again so you know how I'm using it, I'm now speaking of preterism for the generic view that most of the events of the New Testament are completed by the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And we're not talking about partial preterism or full preterism now. We're just using that in the generic sense of those who would like to contend that eschatology is pretty well fulfilled, with the exception of the second coming of Christ, by the events of AD 70. So, according to preterists then, the events of Revelation 13 to 18, which we went through last week in some detail, those events lie in the past and were fulfilled in the first century. And so that means there will be no future manifestation of a Nero-like beast or an end-times antichrist who will persecute the church immediately before our Lord's return at the end of the age. Now, as I've been arguing, as I see it, most preterists were former dispensationalists or have come out of fundamentalism toward Reformation theology, and they are overreacting, I think, against so much of the dispensational overextension with tying current events to biblical prophecy. And so one of the ways to solve that is to just push everything back in the past and take it off the table, and it's no longer an issue. As I've argued many, many times, and I won't go through it again tonight, I think there's a pronounced tension in the New Testament between things fulfilled and things yet to be fulfilled. This already not yet, this age to come tension, I think it's the pervasive eschatology of the New Testament. And so if you take that tension and cut through it, futurists push all of the eschatology into the New Testament off until the time of the end. And that's the problem we see in our dispensational friends who don't take seriously the fact that in the book of Revelation, John says he's writing about things that are soon to come to pass. On the other hand, preterists then remove eschatology by and large from the New Testament by pushing everything back into the past. And I think that's a problem on both sides. I think there's that pronounced tension between those two things, and I think we have to hold those things in their proper tension to make sense of a number of things taught in the New Testament. Now, if it can be shown that the book of Revelation was written after AD 70, the preterist interpretation of the beast as a figure entirely of the past becomes untenable. And while the case for the view of Antichrist and the beast that I'm going to present tonight is surely strengthened by a post-AD 70 dating of Revelation, the overall case for my position as a Reformed amillenarian is not dependent on the book of Revelation. So the third point listed, I'm going to basically make the case that I think the evidence points toward the late date between 90 and 95. I think the circumstantial evidence is pretty much overwhelming in that direction. But Reformed amillennialism doesn't stand or fall at all on the date of the book of Revelation. you have people like Jay Adams and others who are Reformed and amillennial and yet see a pre-AD 70 date for the book of Revelation. But if you're a preterist and the book of Revelation is written after AD 70, then preterism collapses. There are a number of issues then that are raised. So this really is a point that preterists have to make, that the book of Revelation is written before AD 70, and that's why there's so much interest in the date of Revelation. It comes out of the preterist camp because it's really a non-issue for my position. But it's a huge issue if you're a preterist. You have to show that early date, or else your position is greatly weakened. So someone like Ken Gentry, in his book Before Jerusalem Fell, which is a significant book on the topic, argues for a pre-AD 70 date. He would hold the full preterist position that these events are largely fulfilled. He's, of course, not a hyper-preterist in any sense and holds an orthodox view of the second coming and so on. But there are a number of other scholars that hold to an early date that don't fit the amillennial or preterist camp. These would be critical scholars. I'm thinking of someone like John A.T. Robinson, who wrote his famous book, Redating the New Testament, when Robinson makes a very compelling argument that every book of the New Testament was written before AD 70, including the book of Revelation. And I tend to, just so you know, be on the side that says, yeah, I think that thesis is probably sustainable. I think there's a lot of evidence that shows the books of the New Testament were written early on rather than later, except for the Apocalypse. And I think the evidence for the Apocalypse being written much later is pretty much overwhelming. Another critical scholar that is quoted often is J.M. Ford, who has some very bizarre views about the book of Revelation, a very liberal scholar, who believes that this John, in fact, may indeed be someone associated with John the Baptist, and no other scholars accept that position as tenable. And then there are the three famed English New Testament scholars who dominated the world of biblical scholarship well into the early part of the century. I'm thinking of people like Westcott, Horton, and Lightfoot, who have done a very good job in arguing for this early date. Their arguments, I think, are the most cogent and salient. But you end up with that small minority of scholars arguing for the early date when virtually all critical scholars, all evangelical scholars, opt for the so-called late date around AD 95 during the reign of Domitian. Now, I think we have to talk about methodology here just briefly. There really isn't a smoking gun argument. There is no smoking gun piece of evidence that definitively dates the book of Revelation for us. And so we have to look at this by basically looking at evidence that's currently available and then assuming that this is going to be a probability case. What does the general thrust of the evidence say about the date of the book of Revelation? And I think it's important we lay that out methodologically, because as I read, for example, Ken Gentry's book or some of the others, Gary DeMar and others, I get the strong sense that for theological reasons, elsewhere they've adopted preterism. And then come to the book of Revelation and say, that has to be written before AD 70, or else what I've assumed elsewhere cannot be true. And so you get the sense then that this is a theory in search of facts. So I think this is a theological argument for preterism that then has to approach the book of Revelation instead of saying, what is the overall sense of this book? What does the internal and external evidence say about when it was written? And looks at Revelation and says, how do I get this before AD 70? So you end up with a number of very odd interpretations of passages that scholars have generally rejected, and preterists have to assume these things to make the argument stick. Now, I'm going to go back to one point that I skipped because I think it's important to touch on here. I'm of the opinion that these arguments for the early date of Revelation seem very contrived. And that is, preterism is assumed, and then you look at the book of Revelation and find all the areas that could possibly hint at an early date and force that interpretation upon those. So that's methodologically how I'm going to respond to some of this here as we go through the points tonight. Now, what are the arguments for the early date of the book of Revelation? By early date, I mean before AD 70. What are these arguments and how do they work? Well, the first one is found in Revelation chapter 11. So you may want to turn there and look through that. I'm going to just read it off the text here. In Revelation 11, verses 1 to 12, and we're going to concentrate here on the first couple of verses momentarily. John mentions the Jerusalem temple, supposedly, according to preterists, as though it were currently standing when he was given his vision. And so obviously, this seems like a very strong point, that if the temple was still standing when John recorded his vision, then the book of Revelation must have been written after the temple's destruction at the hands of before the temple's destruction at the hand of the Romans in AD 70. So if it can be shown that John refers to the temple as though the temple were still standing, that necessitates a terminal date of AD 70, and therefore Revelation has to be written before that. The passage that I want to appeal to first, the first two verses of Revelation 11, John records the vision as follows. I was given a reed-like measuring rod and was told, go and measure the temple of God and the altar and count the worshipers there. But exclude the outer court, do not measure it, because it has been given to the Gentiles. They will trample on the city, the holy city, for 42 months. So the argument runs as follows. If John is speaking of the temple in Jerusalem, and it's still standing when John's given his vision, then this demands a date of composition before the temple was destroyed. Now, on the face of it, that seems like a very strong argument. So what do those who reject the pre-AD 70 argument say? Now, I think the response is just very simply to notice that the passage uses very highly symbolic language throughout, and that obviously points us away from a physical temple to a spiritual interpretation of the temple as the church. Now, it's one thing to say that. How are you going to prove that? And that's the criticism that all millenarians always get from our dispensational friends. Well, you just made the passage a wax nose. You're going to just twist it all over the place. How on earth are you going to prove that point? Well, let's follow this through here momentarily and look at the passage in a bit more detail and see if that isn't the plain reading. Now, G.B. Caird, famous commentator on the book of Revelation, he makes this point, and I think you have to keep this in mind. In a book in which all things are expressed in symbols, the very last things the temple and the holy city could mean would be the physical temple and the earthly Jerusalem. Remember, everything in the book of Revelation we saw several weeks ago has to be read through two lenses. One is, where do we find that in the Old Testament? We've argued that the book of Revelation is basically a divinely given commentary on the Old Testament, summing up all those things left undone. And the second thing is the historical situation when John is writing, and that is the Roman Empire lurking behind everything. And so all of these words that appear in Revelation, loaded with symbolism, have to be seen against the Old Testament backdrop. And so as Caird points out, he says, look, if John's referring to the Jerusalem temple as it's still standing, then a rather remarkable thing is said to occur here. What do you get if the preterist argument is in fact true? Well, the Gentiles, who according to this pre-AD 70 dating, and that would mean the armies of Titus, who invade Jerusalem, destroy the city and the temple, they would occupy the outer court of the temple for 3.5 years, but leave the inner court and the altar undefiled. Now think about that for a minute. That didn't happen when the temple was destroyed, and it lacks any connection to the historical events of AD 70. Read Josephus. The temple complex falls in one big push. There's no time where the Romans occupy the outer court for 3.5 years while the inner court is remaining pristine. That never happens. And so if this is a prophecy, it didn't come to pass because the historical events are greatly different. It also ignores John's use of these metaphors of Jerusalem and the temple and the metaphor of the outer court and the inner sanctuary where the altar is. But the passage makes perfect sense if the temple had already been destroyed when John writes, because the time of the Gentiles was already underway. The outer court was presently being trampled, while the true court, the heavenly temple, remains undefiled because it is protected by God. The outer court in the symbolism is the Gentiles overrunning the church, but the inner court always remains pristine. Why? It is in heaven. See, already not yet. And so the passage then makes much better sense if, in fact, these are symbols of the church and the heavenly temple. Now, Revelation 11, 3 to 11 goes on to tell of two witnesses who prophesy for the same period of time as the outer court is trampled by the Gentiles. That is this language of 1,260 days or 42 months. And as I argue in my book, in both books actually, I think in Revelation these are interpreted to be the entire interadvental age. And these flow out of the last part of the prophecy of Daniel of the 70 weeks. And so John then interprets that final 3.5 years of Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks as the entire interadvental period. Now, if that's true, in the first part of Revelation chapter 11, verses 1 to 2, John is again speaking of the entire interadvental period. And we see this in Revelation 11, 3 to 11, the rest of this particular vision. Because here there are two witnesses, and they prophesy for that same amount of time, and they exercise miracle power that calls to mind, at least it should, the images of Moses and Elijah, and who then are slain by the beast in the great city. And what's that city called in verses 3 to 11? Not Jerusalem. What's it called? Anybody remember? Sodom and Egypt. So do we really want to say this is the literal Jerusalem temple? I don't think so, because John goes on to use all kinds of images drawn again from the Old Testament of Sodom and Egypt. And these witnesses then are slain only to be raised from the dead. And I take that to mean a picture of the martyrs preaching the gospel throughout the course of that age. When Satan, the beast, appears to kill them, they just come back stronger than ever with greater power than they had before. This is the promise of Jesus that the gates of hell will not prevail against his church. Now, based on that account from John, then, the time period is very likely a symbolic description of that entire period between Christ's first and his second coming, not that time immediately before the temple's destroyed in AD 70. That's in the lifetime of the apostles. In fact, if you look at this closely, this is Beale's argument. I think this is very, very compelling. Beale says the measurements given by John to the angel do not reflect in any sense the historical temple at Jerusalem. Instead, what do they reflect? The vision of Ezekiel chapters 40 to 48 of that heavenly temple, which is regarded by almost all commentators as a reference to the church. And so it's important to recall that John isn't instructed to measure a temple that's still standing in Jerusalem. Rather, the angel instructs John to measure the temple he sees before him in the heavenly vision. And that's, I think, demonstrated by the fact that the 42 months and the times of the Gentiles are much more likely a reference to the interadvental period and not limited to that time right before AD 70. So I think on the face of it, the passage makes much more sense to see this as post-AD 70 instead of pre-AD 70, because if it is pre-AD 70, this doesn't fit the historical circumstances. If it's post-AD 70, it would follow the use of the metaphor throughout the book of Revelation that the temple on earth, the church on earth, is constantly under assault from the beast and his forces, and yet the heavenly church, the church triumphant, is unassailable because it's in heaven and protected by Christ. So I think the passage makes much more sense post-AD 70. Second argument. Our preterist friends will say that in Revelation 17, verses 9 to 11, the chronology of the kings mentioned by John requires a date before AD 70. We spent a lot of time on that passage last week, but let's turn there again. Revelation 17, 9 to 11. I'd just like to read the passage briefly. John, in this vision of the great prostitute and the beast, says, "This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated, As I argued last time, there is no way John's readers understood this to refer to anything but the city of Rome. That's clearly what's implied by the city with seven hills. So, there are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other's not yet come, and when he does, he must remain for a little while only. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth king, and it belongs to the seven, but it goes on to destruction. So there are eight kings in view here, and it's argued then by preterists that these kings are a reference to contemporary emperors before the time of Nero, and that the first in this series of kings is either Emperor Augustus or Julius Caesar, and then the sixth king would be Nero. And both of whom, then, if that's true, if you follow this from either Augustus or Julius Caesar, follow the six emperors through, and this is supposedly Nero, then this would require a chronology of a pre-AD 70 date. Now, on the face of it, I think that's the strongest of all of the preterist arguments. But as Beale and others have pointed out, there are a number of real problems with that historical identification. Now, I know Ken Gentry is very confident that this can be done relatively easily, but I don't think that's necessarily the case, because the question is, with which emperor do you start counting? Who's the first of these five kings? And then who's the sixth, and who would the seventh be, and then who's the eighth? And remember, the eighth king is still off in the future. And as I argued last time, that eighth king is really the reminder that the beast not only imitates the death and resurrection of Christ, the beast also imitates Christ's second coming. And so you have this manifestation of a final beast at the end of the age, that eighth king who appears off at the end of time. And so I think the preterist interpretation basically ignores that kind of apocalyptic structure here that's in the passage. So do you begin with Augustus? Do you begin with Julius Caesar? And then you have a problem. Are all the emperors to be counted in that series, or only those emperors who participated in the imperial cult? There are four emperors who rule for a very short period of time. If you include them, the whole chronology gets messed up and it doesn't work. So this isn't as easy to do as some of our preterist friends would like to believe. More importantly, how does the preterist interpretation square with Revelation 17:11? Because we read of the beast who once was and now is not, who is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. How does this list fit? How do you get the eighth king in here? He's yet future. So that seems to fit with what we argued last time for a first century fulfillment in Nero being replaced by Domitian. Domitian comes back with even more fury than Nero did, and that pointing ahead then to a final manifestation of evil before Christ returns at the time of the end. That seems to make much better sense. And by the way, that's exactly what John says here in Revelation chapter 17. So I think that the preterist argument for these being kings pointing up to Nero is very hard to defend. Now, let's suppose preterism's true and that argument's right. Either then John is teaching a literal resurrection of one of the earlier kings, and hence this Nero myth that we see coming back again and again, or else this is symbolic language that points us in the direction of a non-literal interpretation of the succession of leaders. And I think that's an option we have to consider. Is John giving us a lesson in Roman history? And I think that's the question we have to ask. Preterists, of course, say yes to that. And this is a real chronology that everyone should immediately understand. How many kings are there? There are five, six. The prophecy seems to be fulfilled by the seventh and pushing ahead to an eighth. Whenever you see the number seven in the book of Revelation, that tells you what? We're talking about a completion, a fulfillment. So listen to how a number of critical and evangelical scholars have tackled this. Beasley Murray says, and I think he's right, this whole procedure of identifying emperors should be viewed as misguided. John is not only giving his... let me read him again. John is not giving his readers a history lesson, nor is he speaking to the question of the exact number of the Roman emperors. As J.M. Sweet points out, John's readers all knew about Nero, but were as unlikely to have known the succession of emperors as readers today know that of the presidents of the United States. You know, this assumes, if you've ever seen Jay Leno, and Jay Leno walks up to people, you know, and asks them, who was the president 4 terms ago? Can they tell you? Most of them can't. He's making the point that the Romans are much like our contemporaries. They're not really interested in this kind of stuff, and they'd know who it was if you told them. But in other words, that wasn't the point of this vision. It wasn't a lesson in the history of Roman emperors. The number 7 is used throughout Revelation as a symbolic number of completeness. And therefore, as Caird points out in his wry sense of humor, John did not arrive at the number 7 by counting emperors. The number 7 is not to give us a lesson in Roman history. It is to tell us that when these emperors have come and gone, what God has ordained is complete. Then comes the 8th and final king. That, I think, is what John's trying to tell us. And I think the critical scholars and the evangelical scholars are generally correct about this. John's point, then, would be that the church must face persecution throughout the entire present evil age, the completeness of this period symbolized by 7 emperors, and the church must not suffer. The church must suffer not only under the 7th king throughout the course of this age, but at the end of time face this 8th king, who will arise in conjunction with the releasing of Satan from the abyss. Remember, at the end of the interadvental period, Satan is released from the abyss. He goes forth to deceive the nations. And I think John has told us again and again and again throughout Revelation that the first century church facing Rome is a picture to Christians throughout all ages of the God-hating beast persecuting God's people. And then at the time of the end, when Satan is released, we face one last, final, and terrible manifestation of the beast, of the dragon empowering the beast, or the state. And I think that's what John is telling us here in Revelation chapter 17. So, the identification of the kings then, in this passage, far more difficult than people would like to believe, I think. And the issue for John's reader really isn't the chronology of the emperors. I think John's readers would be more interested in knowing who that 8th king was. I don't know about you, that's the king that I would be more worried about than the series that I had lived through. Who is this final king who was and who is not, and who is this false Christ-like figure who's yet to come? So if you take the preterist position, you've got a big problem, because John's readers are worried about the guy yet to come, the Christ figure, who looks like a lamb but really is a roaring beast. So I don't think the preterist interpretation of this passage makes the best sense. Now, argument 3 for an early date of the book of Revelation is one we spent a little bit of time on last week. And that is, since the number 666 likely refers to Nero, and we granted that that number probably does refer to Nero, it may indeed be a reference to Nero, but as I tried to argue last time, I think to speculate about the individual misses the theological import of the number 666. 6 is the number of man, always trying to attain deity and never making it. 666 is a number that tells us of something that is perfectly imperfect, that can never rise to the level of deity. And so Nero may have been the first to be identified as this emperor who desires to be divine and who claims divine prerogatives and who never can. But he's not the last. He's a picture of God-hating beasts that are going to arise throughout the course of this age. Adolf Hitler, Stalin, I mean, we see a whole list of these kind of guys that appear again and again in the course of history and are always seeking divine prerogatives and yet never able to get there, always working, never coming to rest. There's just a lot of theological import to that number that people overlook by being so preoccupied with figuring out who it is, instead of what it is. Now, the preterist position is that if this refers to Nero, then Revelation was written during or shortly after Nero's reign. Nero's reign came to an end in AD 68 with his apparent suicide. And somehow this vision was completed before AD 70. Now, as we've seen, since the number 666 is at least as theological in its significance as it is historical, what's symbolized by that number extends beyond Nero to all state leaders who oppose Christ and His kingdom. That's not just a Roman emperor. If you want to know what it's going to be like, Nero's a picture to us. But any time a leader of the state takes unto himself divine prerogatives and thinks of himself as an object of worship, he in fact is manifesting what Nero did to the early church. So this isn't fulfilled by AD 70. As a matter of fact, the first century fulfillment points to continual fulfillment across time and to a final fulfillment at the end of time. That would fit with this beast dying and rising and then returning again just as our Lord has. And so no question here, Nero's in the mind of John's readers, but Nero's reign of terror doesn't exhaust the prophecy of Revelation 13. Now remember, the beast imitates the resurrection of Christ when his deadly wound is healed. And John's probably making the point that even though Nero was long dead, he had in fact returned in a sense through the person of Domitian. Because Domitian is the one currently persecuting the church when John's given this vision. You know, it looked like the beast had come to life, had tormented the church, terrorized the church. Nero put Peter to death, he put Paul to death, he used Christians as torches in his garden, he did all these horrible things, and then he commits suicide. And everybody goes, "Ah, he's dead." Now, 25 years later, it's even worse. It's now spread into Asia Minor, where the churches of the book of Revelation exist, and it's back even worse under Domitian. Because whereas Nero thought of himself as a demigod, Domitian not only thinks of himself as a god, it's Domitian, not Nero, who's insisting that people worship his image. So it has come back with a vengeance. It's worse than it was before. And so this is the Nero myth. Nero come back. It's probably in the form of this ongoing emperor cult, culminating with Domitian. The beast is present when John writes Revelation in the form of this revived Roman Empire. And it's natural to see John warning Christians across time of what to expect when they encounter what Richard Bauckham, I think, beautifully calls a deification of power. This is the state taking to itself divine prerogatives. This is the leader of the state, the second beast from the land, trying to get the nations of the world to worship the state. So, I mean, I'm with Augustine on that. This goes back to Augustine, that the false prophet is the leader of the state, the beast is the state, and the dragon is Satan who empowers them all. So I think this is an image of something that's ongoing, not something that's limited to the events of AD 70. And so this opposition then from a series of beasts will continue until the end of the age when it intensifies and this eighth and final beast is revealed to be destroyed by Christ at His second coming. Now, argument number four is the reference to Babylon throughout the book of Revelation is symbolic of Jerusalem and apostate Judaism. This is one aspect of the preterist position that on the one hand has apparently a lot of evidence for it and yet collapses, I think, the quickest upon inspection. This is one of those when you read the preterist argument and you think, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'd never thought of that before. And then as you start to examine it, you realize that that argument is pretty specious. Now, in Revelation 11, verse 8, we read of the two witnesses. Their bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom in Egypt, where their Lord was crucified. So it's argued then that Jerusalem, the place where the Lord was crucified, is therefore identified as the great city. And then, according to preterists, if you go ahead to Revelation 18, the great city is specifically identified as Babylon. And so that means that the destruction of Babylon in AD 70 fulfills the prophecy of the destruction of Babylon in Revelation chapter 18. So Jerusalem then is Babylon. When Jerusalem is destroyed in AD 70, the Babylonian whore is destroyed. And all those images are pulled out of the Old Testament that seem to imply that apostate Jerusalem really is like Babylon. And there are a number of passages, probably 8 to 10 of them, that seem to make that point that Israel has become a spiritual Babylon. And so our preterist friends will say, see, if Babylon's Jerusalem, Then Babylon is destroyed before AD 70, and that argues then for the earlier date of the book of Revelation. Now the problem with that is, very simply, that the same verse that's used to identify the great city as the place where Jesus is crucified isn't just called Jerusalem, it's also called Sodom and Egypt. Now that suggests, I think, very clearly a non-literal reading of that passage, especially in light of the fact that throughout the book of Revelation, Babylon is clearly a reference to the city of Rome. You can't tell me that somebody hearing John's vision in the first century, hearing of a city with seven mountains and seven hills, didn't immediately think of Rome. And to argue that this is Jerusalem starts to get weaker and weaker and weaker the more you consider it. Sweet makes an interesting point. He says, like Hiroshima is for us, Sodom and Egypt and Babylon and Jerusalem are heavy with meaning. The great city in whose street the witnesses lie cannot, any more than Vanity Fair, be limited to one place and one time. That's John's whole point. The place where the witnesses lie dead is any apostate city in the world that has killed God's messengers. It's like Vanity Fair. It's an ideal. It's a metaphor to show us wherever there are ungodly people and the gospel is preached and they kill them, that's where the witnesses lay in the street. That's where they, from whence they come back. And so the identification of Rome as Babylon, interestingly enough, was made by virtually all Jewish writers and commentators after the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70, but never before. If indeed this is a reference to the city of Jerusalem in the apostolic period, it would be the only place where such an identification is made. The Jews identified Babylon as Rome after Jerusalem fell because Rome did to Jerusalem what the Babylonians did. But the Jews themselves never identified Jerusalem with Babylon. And if that's the case, then this is the only place in the New Testament where that interpretation would be made. And it's very much like the man of sin problem we saw before. If the word Naon there, or temple, is a reference to the Jerusalem temple in 2 Thessalonians, that's the only place in the New Testament where that interpretation is used, because everywhere else in Paul, Naon or temple refers to the church. So if preterists are right, this is a unique reading in the New Testament, and nowhere else in the book of Revelation is the term used of Jerusalem. It's always used of Rome. It's certainly used of Rome in the previous chapter because Rome is a city with seven hills and the series of kings. So this is a classic case of one of those instances where, all right, I've got to get this before AD 70. What am I going to do with this passage? And you force a reading on a text that you would never read that way unless you'd already assumed Revelation was written before AD 70. That, I think, is the methodological problem with preterism. Instead of gathering the evidence and saying, okay, what's the best case here? You've made a theological determination, now you're looking for facts to support it. So you're not doing historical kind of investigation. You're begging the question, I think, before you already start. And this is a very good case of that. Argument 5 is that in Revelation 1, verse 7, John speaks of Jesus as coming on the clouds of judgment, which, as you know, preterists believe to be the events of AD 70. And they argue then that this is a kind of prophetic interpretation, a prophecy basically of Jesus coming in judgment upon Israel in 70, which they say fulfills the prophecy in Zechariah 12:10-12, where the world is equated with Jerusalem, and the mention elsewhere of revelation of tribes then is thought to be a reference to Israel. And so if true, preterists will say, there it is before AD 70. But again, you look at this closely and there are all kinds of problems with that interpretation. For one thing, the prophecy from Zechariah chapter 12 is a reference to Israel's eschatological salvation, not to final judgment. That prophecy is a reference to the time when Israel is going to be saved, which I take to be before the end of the age. It's not a reference to Israel's judgment or destruction, but to Israel's salvation. And then, the peoples of the earth, literally the tribes of the earth, preterists say, that has to refer to Israel. But where in Scripture do we have a reference to the peoples of the earth being a reference to Israel? It's just not there. And so nowhere, unless it's here, then do the tribes of the earth refer to just Israelite tribes. Whenever that's used in the Septuagint, it's translated all nations, not all Israel. And so I think this is a point again where we're on the face of it, oh, the Lord's going to come in judgment on it. That's got to be a prophecy of AD 70. And then when you look at the reference, the prophecy to which it's referring, it's got nothing to do with Israel. It has to do with the nations. And that seems to me, we could have this discussion later on. We probably ought to, and do some more work on the Olivet Discourse, especially in light of preterism. But the idea of coming in the clouds being limited to just Jerusalem doesn't fit with anything in the epistles, because that's always universalized to mean a judgment on the world, not just Israel. So this is another classic case of having to make a text fit with a preconceived idea regarding the date of the book of Revelation. Okay, then, what are the arguments in favor of a post-AD 70 date of authorship? What are the arguments for the other side? Well, I think far and away the most important reason for dating Revelation after AD 70 is the evidence throughout the book of the presence of emperor worship and this imperial cult that underlies much of what takes place through John's vision. In other words, I think the pastoral issue that John is addressing to these seven churches in the book of Revelation is the fact that these churches are beginning to come under tremendous persecution from the Roman emperor cult. They will not worship Domitian. They will not worship the Roman emperor because to them, Jesus is Lord, not Caesar is Lord. And the minute these Christians confess that Jesus is Lord, Caesar gets his shorts in a wad because Caesar thinks he's to be worshipped. And Christians won't go by the little statue of the emperor outside the marketplace and throw in the pinch of incense. They'd rather not go in than do that. Therefore, they are not able to buy and to sell. They're suffering economic deprivation and hardship. There are even cases of Christians being arrested, as in Pergamon with Antipas, arrested and having been put to death already. So I think the historical circumstances in Asia Minor much better fit the time of Domitian than the time of Nero. Remember, Nero's persecution was limited largely to Rome. Now we have it beginning to break out in other parts of the empire. And so it seems to me that this is talking about something that's much later, say 20 years at least later than the time of Nero. You can look in my book for all the passages, I think, that describe the emperor cult in the book of Revelation. Now, as the famous scholar Moffat once put it, whether the persecution of Christians had already become widespread or not, quoting here, the few cases of repressive interference and of martyrdom in Asia Minor and elsewhere were enough to warn John of the storm rolling up on the horizon, though as yet only one or two drops had actually fallen. And I think that fits the pastoral situation with these seven churches. All of a sudden, remember, in Romans 13, Paul had described the Roman Empire as a minister of God. Now, all of a sudden, empowered by the dragon, that state has turned against the church. And Christians are being persecuted, put to death, arrested, and being prevented from buying and selling and suffering great economic hardship. So the persecution of Christians definitely began during the reign of Nero. It wasn't widespread, historians tell us, until the time of Domitian. Domitian lived between 81 and 96. And as several studies of Nero have demonstrated, the evidence shows, I think, very clearly, the persecution of Christians in Rome and not in Asia Minor where John was. And Nero didn't persecute Christians because they didn't worship him. Nero persecuted Christians because they were the scapegoats for the fire that Nero probably started to burn down the hillside so he could build his golden palace there. That's what seemed to be Nero's object of wrath against Christians. He could blame them for starting the fire that he may have started. Well, that's a huge debate among Roman scholars, whether he actually started that fire or not. Now, there are a couple of historical studies of the background of Asia Minor that really have to be considered. One is the famous book by S.R.F. Price called Rituals and Power, The Roman Imperial Cult in Asia Minor. And the other is Leonard Thompson's The Book of Revelation, Apocalypse and Empire. And they both argue that by the time of Domitian's reign, the imperial cult and emperor worship is in full flower. The pictures of emperors are on coins and they're called deities. The imperial seal on any mail had the emperor's name, call him a deity. And that's where we get the language of the mark of the beast. That seal comes right out of Roman mail and the imperial seal. Then we have statues of emperors every place, and the emperors were worshipped as deities. That harkens back to Nebuchadnezzar and the building of the statue and all that kind of stuff. So emperor worship is coming to full flower. Christians are really feeling the weight of this. And so Thompson, for example, in his very interesting and kind of weird interpretation here, he admits that Roman sources depict Domitian as an evil tyrant without exception. But he says, and I don't know how he can conclude this, that under Domitian's time, Christians weren't persecuted empire-wide. And then he turns right around and says, the imperial cult preceded Domitian by many reigns, and it began to intensify under Domitian. So this is a classic case of scholarly equivocation, I guess. It really wasn't that bad. Even though Roman sources said it was terrible, it really wasn't that bad. Oh, but under Domitian, Christians began to be persecuted. Okay. Now, the only firm date we have in any of this is 113 A.D. This is the only date we've got in concrete. Pliny, a Roman author and senator, wrote a letter to the Emperor Trajan, who was the emperor who came after Domitian. And he had a question. And that question had to do with Christians who refused to worship the emperor. And Trajan replied that Christians were not to be sought out and executed, but if they did not worship the emperor and were convicted by a court, they were to be put to death. 117. So that much better fits the depiction of the conditions in Revelation at a later date, the time of Domitian, than the time of an earlier date before AD 70. Because what was the practice, whether official or otherwise, by the time of Domitian, by the time of Trajan, rather, began in Domitian, and many Roman historians themselves say that is the most volatile time in Roman history when Domitian was the emperor. And sadly, Pliny, in his letter to Trajan, goes on to say that there were Christians who had apostatized from their faith as long as 25 years ago when the persecution began to be intense. So in Pliny's letter, writing to Trajan, saying, what do we do with these Christians? Do we arrest them? Do we hunt them down? Trajan says, no, don't seek them out, but if they won't worship the emperor, put them to death. He refers to apostasy beginning 25 years before. Do the math, 117 minus 25. That gets you a date of about early 90s, not 70. So everything we have pushes us toward this later date in terms of external evidence. And that is a very sad case because here we have Christians who renounce their faith. And Pliny speaks of this as going on as much as 25 years before. So I think you can make the case that the seeds of this, yes, begin under Nero, but, and while it's possible Revelation was written under Neronian persecution, the evidence just is much greater that this occurs under Domitian and that this is an escalation that is not in Rome but is spread now into Asia Minor, and historically that happens much later than the reign of Emperor Nero. And so as one scholar puts it, quote, the evidence points much better to the time of Domitian. Now, argument two for a post-AD 70 date is that the historical situation facing the seven churches in Revelation 2 and 3 seems much better in line with the circumstances after AD 70 than does a date before AD 70. There's a famous book by Colin Hemmer called The Letters to the Seven Churches in Asia and Their Local Settings. He picks up where William Ramsey had left off. And he argues, I think in a very compelling way, that the churches in Revelation 2 and 3 are under a persecution that's much more like the time of Domitian. And that includes evidence of persecution in these particular provinces from local authorities. And that explains why three of these churches, Smyrna and Pergamon and Philadelphia, were presently experiencing persecution when John writes the letter to them. There's also evidence of Jews living in these same areas who, to avoid the persecution of the imperial cult, pay tribute to Caesar to avoid persecution, and who rat out Christians and other Jews who are not paying tribute. And so there's this kind of turn-on-your-own thing going on here during this period of time, and that would fit with some of the circumstances facing these churches where their own members now are ratting them out for attending Christian worship services, which is causing them to be arrested. And this was affecting not only Christians, but the Jews as well. There are a couple of other things I think we have to consider in these seven churches. The first is the spiritual lethargy of the church in Ephesus. Now remember in Revelation 2, verses 1 to 7, the church in Ephesus is guilty of, anybody remember what that was? Losing its first love. And that seems to, I think, presuppose a time well after the establishment of that church in the mid-50s. We know that the church in Ephesus was founded in the early 50s. Would John warn them before AD 70 that they'd lost their first love? Or would that not be more likely to have taken more time than that? That's not a concrete argument. It's a probabilistic argument. Which is more likely? Well, obviously the latter is more likely. And that's what I'm getting at when I said we don't have a smoking gun here historically. We just have evidence, and the evidence seems to point naturally in that later date. We also have the church of Laodicea, which is described as wealthy. But we know from Roman sources that a huge earthquake decimated that entire area in AD 61. And would that church have recovered its wealth sometime before AD 70? That's not likely. But by AD 95, we know from Roman sources that church had regained much of its wealth and its prestige. And then there's a church in Pergamon that had been home to a man named Antipas, who had been put to death as a Christian martyr sometime earlier, and that persecution broke out years before, and John speaks of Antipas' death as way in the past. And that seems to point to 95. Someone had died, say, in the late 80s, as opposed to somebody writing about 68, 69, and he died in the 50s. It just seems to point to the later date in every one of these circumstances in these churches. Now, Beale tells us, and I think Beale's absolutely right, there is no evidence that Nero's persecution of Christians after the Great Fire in the city of Rome ever extended into Asia Minor where these churches are located. It just isn't there. This clearly seems to fit a later date. Now, what's the preterist's response to this argument? Well, Ken Gentry says, and I'm quoting, "These arguments do not carry sufficient weight to serve as an anchor for the late date theory." Well, I'm not saying they prove the late date theory, but I'm saying they certainly make a lot more sense if the later date were true than they do if the earlier date were true. And that's my point from the very beginning, that as I look at these preterist arguments, I get the sense that they've made a theological judgment elsewhere, and dadgummit, Revelation is going to fit that judgment. When, in fact, if you just looked at the evidence, you wouldn't come up with that particular conclusion. And so I think the preterist arguments again and again seem very contrived here because you've already assumed a second coming date of AD 70, coming in judgment. Argument 3, the image of Babylon in Revelation is always a reference to imperial Roman power and greed. It is not a reference to Jerusalem. I think this is the strongest argument for a later date because in all known Jewish literature written after AD 70, and the destruction of the temple, Rome is universally identified as Babylon because, like the ancient Babylonians, Rome sacked Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. So if John's writing to Jewish Christians throughout these churches, Babylon to them would immediately be a reference to Rome because Rome had done to Jerusalem what the Babylonians did. And I think it's a real stretch to say, no, the reference to Babylon is a reference to apostate Jerusalem. And where, the anti-Semitism jumps out of this. I'm not saying preterists are anti-Semitic, but there is this whole cultural line that people pick up on. Well, we all know the Jews are merchants, right? So the language of Babylon the Great committing harlotry with the merchants of the world, well, that sounds like something Jews would do. That is in there. But would the first century audience think of it like that? I don't think there's any way they would have made that connection to Jerusalem and the temple. It was clearly a reference to Rome, because Rome did to Jerusalem and the temple exactly what the Babylonians did, and that's why every Jewish commentator sees it just like that. And so I think that becomes a very, very strong argument for the late date. Argument four, the testimony of the Church Fathers is unanimous in affirming the late date. Again, Church Fathers are not biblical texts. I'm always amazed at Rome that says, you know, we think we need an infallible church to interpret Scripture, but the Church Fathers are quoted as though they're self-interpreting. You can find Church Fathers saying contradictory things on the same page. I'm almost convinced Joseph Smith is right that there was an apostasy after the apostles. I'm teasing. But when the Church Fathers are unanimous about something, I think that has to be weighed. That's additional historical evidence. What do the Church Fathers say? Well, they're unanimous for the late date. Clement and Eusebius and Origen and Irenaeus, among others, all state the book was written by John during the latter part of Domitian. And yes, they could all be mistaken. Yes, they could all be utilizing an erroneous tradition. But there is no evidence for anybody arguing for a pre-AD 70 date of authorship. And the absence of any contrary position, I think, is a very, very interesting argument from silence again. You have to be careful not to make more out of it than it really is. But it's an interesting point that tends to push things in the later date again. Irenaeus puts it this way. He says, and I'm quoting, where did I lost my place? I hate it when that happens. Quoting, that the identity of the Antichrist would have been announced by him who beheld the apocalypse, for it was seen not very long ago in our day toward the end of Domitian's reign. So that's most often taken to mean that John wrote Revelation as an old man. He'd been exiled on Patmos before Domitian died in AD 96. And so I think Irenaeus very strongly supports the traditional late dating. As a matter of fact, the late dating comes from the Church Fathers. Now, Gentry, on the other hand, realizes the significance of Irenaeus' argument, and he contends that what was seen wasn't the apocalypse, but John. And I think Greg Beale does a good job of taking him to the woodshed and arguing that everybody argues that what was seen refers to the object, which is the book of Revelation, not to John, who was who's not the subject of the verb was seen. And that's why I think everybody, other than Gentry, believes that Irenaeus' reading of that is referring to the book of Revelation was seen during the time of Domitian. Interestingly, that Irenaeus himself speaks about this, and he makes no reference to Nero, but he speaks to a Latinus, who is the ancient king of the Latins, and he thinks that the Antichrist is going to appear after the Roman Empire falls, and he makes no mention of Nero in this, or an early date. So Irenaeus might be wrong, and that's certainly possible, but I think the Greek text is pretty clear. He's talking about the appearance of the book of Revelation during the time of Domitian, not that John was seen still alive during the time of Domitian. I think that's another case of assuming something and then having to prove it. Now, all of that is to say, this is a probabilistic case. We don't know when the book of Revelation was written. We can't say with any certainty when it was written. But I think the preterist arguments that at first glance look like they've got some pretty good substance behind them all seem to evaporate pretty quickly upon close inspection. And that by the time you put all this together, it's much more likely that the book of Revelation was written later rather than earlier. And again, remember, an argument is only as strong as its weakest point. My position isn't going to be refuted one way or the other if the book of Revelation is shown to be written concretely by somebody in AD 68. It's really not even going to change, but more than a couple of texts in the book of Revelation. I mean, it's not going to affect my overall interpretation of Revelation at all. But if the book of Revelation is written late, preterism's got real problems. And that's why the early date for the book of Revelation is so important. And that's why preterists are so, what's the term I want to use? I think their arguments are very contrived in trying to show the early date. Because if it is late, there's some real problems there. And that's why this is a far bigger issue for preterists than it is for anybody else, and why they're so concerned with the day of the book of Revelation. But I don't know that I've ever dealt with this in any form, and I thought at some point it probably a good idea to do so. If this is of interest to you, the field is New Testament Introduction. Read Carson, Moo, and Morris. Read Donald Guthrie's New Testament Introduction. Read Westcott and Hort, who are the best on the early date. Read some guys before the current debate, you know, is going on, because I think their arguments are better. They're not loaded with tension. And then look at Beale's overall interpretation of the book of Revelation. I think you'll find it makes much more sense that eighth king is someone yet future, and that really becomes a huge problem for those who want to push all this back before AD 70. So it's a probability case, and I think the argument stands strongly on the side of the late date. We have time for some questions. Go to the mic.
I had just more clarification on one of the preterist arguments.
Yeah.
In verse 7.
Of what?
Every eye will see him, even those who pierced him. How would you see that or interpret that? I know you kind of went over that, but I really wanted to be precise on that to know what you thought about that.
Yeah, I cover that.
Like the piercing part in particular, like who are those that pierced
him? Right, I cover that in some detail in my chapter, so I would refer you to that. I also refer you to Greg Beale's treatment of that because it's outstanding. Preterists have to say that refers to Christ coming in judgment in the clouds against Jerusalem in AD 70. Is that what the passage is saying? Or is it talking about every eye shall see him and the nations will weep and mourn? It's the same problem in the Olivet Discourse. Yes, Christ comes in judgment, but it's not localized to Jerusalem, it's universal. It's eschatological. This is referring to the eschaton, not just a judgment on Jerusalem in AD 70. The central theme in New Testament eschatology is Christ's second advent. I mean, that is what all of eschatology is pointing forward to. And to cut all of that off and squish all of that back before 70 really cuts a lot. It really does great damage to the epistles, especially, that teach the parousia, the epiphania, all of that's reference to the second coming, the bodily resurrection, all of that stuff. Yes, sir.
Just to follow up on what he was saying, how does Zechariah 12 being quoted by John at the crucifixion of Christ, how does that factor into all of this?
Yeah. All of those events are kind of these little flashes from the transfiguration. All of those things are pointing ahead typologically to the second coming. And judgment, it depends on how you read Romans chapter 1, but in the cross, we not only see God's salvation, we see God's wrath being poured out on sin. So that's why when Christ dies on the cross, there are also these cosmic manifestations, very much like we saw in the Transfiguration. So they're little flashes, they're little foreshadowings, they're typological pictures of the second coming. Because that is the heart and soul of New Testament eschatology, is that glorious day of the Lord when Christ comes to judge the world and raise the dead and make all things new.
The question I had.
Beale's got a great discussion of that in his commentary, so you find that real helpful.
You mentioned the chronology of the kings.
Yeah.
The first seven kings. It gets all messed up, and I didn't quite follow you there. Could you?
Ken Gentry is of the opinion that it's pretty straightforward. And it's been a while since I've looked at it. I think he wants to start with Julius Caesar, if I'm not mistaken. It may be Augustus, but is it Caesar? Yeah. And if you follow that through, the sixth king then would be Nero. Mm-hmm. But why not start with Augustus?
Well,
it's kind of arbitrary as which king you start with.
Well, what would happen if you do start with Augustus?
Then Nero's not the sixth king.
Well, who's the king? Who's the sixth king then?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Gentry that. It does, to my interpretation, it doesn't matter. To Gentry, it's huge.
I don't think so. The king after Nero also was before AD 70.
And do we count the kings that were part of the imperial emperor cult or not? That's the question that the critical scholars have about that position, because it assumes that we know this when we may not necessarily know.
Who's we? Who's the we you're referring to?
The consensus of critical scholarship that would reject that position. And then you've got the problem of dealing with the ideal number of seven that, as Carrot and others point out, and we're not getting a lesson in Roman history here. We're being told that when this whole process is complete, then the eighth king comes. It's an eschatological image. It's not a contemporary, it's not a lesson in Roman history. It's eschatological. It's pointing us to the end. And that's the difference of interpretation between preterists and Reformed non-millenarians. And I think Gentry's much more optimistic about what that passage says than he should be.
Well, that's what I was asking. I don't see how whether you start the counting at Augustus or Caesar if it messes up Gentry's argument at all.
Well, it would seem to me that you've got to get Nero as the sixth king.
Now, why is that?
Ask Gentry, because he's the one who makes a big deal of the beast being Nero.
Okay. Well, Gentry's not here.
He's not here, and I think that's why that interpretation is really, really problematic.
All right.
The whole thing's got, in other words, it has to work out just so, or the whole thing's gone.
Well, the only thing that Gentry has to prove is that whoever the sixth king is, he's before AD 70. So if you start at Caesar,
agreed.
If you start at Caesar or Augustus, you still get the sixth
agreed.
King before AD 70.
And then you have a seventh king living when Revelation's written, and an eighth king yet to come.
Right.
And I just think that becomes more preoccupied with the names of the kings and their chronology than with the big picture, which is the ideal period of time those kings rule, followed by the eighth king, which seems to fit the image in Revelation 13 of the beast wounded, dying, apparently coming back to life, and then coming again at the end of the age. Wait. You have to go to the mic before you ask.
There has to be a divorce between the theological teaching and the historical teaching. Why can't you have both?
The question is, why can't you have both? I think you certainly could. But I think to be preoccupied with the chronology of the kings misses the fact that when the seventh king runs its course, then we have the eighth king. In other words, it's an eschatological image. And I can live with the chronology of kings as long as you give me the bigger eschatological picture that's already been developed back in chapter 11, chapter 13. And I think, as I read Gentry and others, you're cutting yourself off from that underlying theme that there's a satanic trinity and a satanic redemption that it mimics the work of Christ. And part of that work of Christ is his death and resurrection. The resurrection's Domitian being back, and his parousia is the eighth king at the end of the age. I think that, in other words, if you push all that back before 70, you're really missing the bigger picture there, which isn't so much the chronology of the kings, but there is an eighth king to come, and that eighth king does come at the time of the end.
Okay.
So, I think you lose all that if the preterist position is correct. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that there were three kings after Nero, or three Caesars after Nero, within a time, I think, of 18 months.
I can't hear you.
There were three
right.
Caesars that came out after Nero.
And then four minor ones, if I'm not mistaken.
Three or four, yeah. Something like that. So, I mean, they're basically pushes Nero back to the second or the first king, you know.
Yeah.
So if you're following a strict chronology and that's what you're basing your theology on,
there's an older commentator by the name of Isbon Beckwith, who has probably 40 pages on that discussion of kings. And if you start with this king, you get this. If you start with that king, you get this. And at the end of it all, he just says, there's no way you can make sense of this.
Yeah.
If you're trying to do the chronology, it just breaks down all over the place.
I was just going to point out, I
would suggest that you take a look at that, because that's been the best historical treatment of that by anybody. It's Isbon Beckwith.
Seems like that the preterists and the dispensationalists both, where they sort of mess up is when they look at an apocalyptic literature and then try to take bits and pieces out of it as literally and then other bits and pieces out of it as symbolically. So,
yeah, I think, again, as I argued before, remember the book of Revelation is very complex. It is a letter. It contains prophecy, and its genre is apocalyptic. And you've got to be very careful here that in a chapter like Revelation 17, even if you do have contemporary kings in the foreground, you can't cut out the apocalyptic imagery those kings are getting at in the long run. And that's my concern with preterism, is it just eliminates all the eschatological in a number of places in the book. Chapter 11 is a great instance of that. And yet, on the other hand, some of the older Amill guys like Hendrickson didn't take the historical stuff going on in the background seriously enough and made it all ideal. And I sort of think people like Johnson and Beale are really good correctives to some of the older Amill people, because they are keeping the chronologies of these things in the foreground and saying, look, that is, speaks to John's contemporary audience, but that's not what the passage is about. Follow up.
In regards to the argument number one for the late date theory, just wondering what you say about the... you were given an argument for the late date of persecution. What you would say about the book of Acts portraying the church being persecuted by the Jews via the Roman authorities. Romans 10:9 and Acts 4:12 seem to be a response to Roman persecution as well. So what I'm basically saying, it seems like the biblical evidence shows that there was persecution by the Romans.
If I read the book of Acts right, what passage are you referring to in the book of Acts? Acts, you said 4?
No, 4:12. There's no other name given among men.
Yeah, but who's that proclaimed to?
He's taking a Roman saying and he's Christianizing it.
But he's talking to Jews, not Romans. And remember, all the way through the book of Acts, Paul, when he gets in trouble, appeals to Roman law as his defense against Jewish charges. Hey, I can go all the way to Caesar with this because I'm a Roman citizen. So in the book of Acts, even with Paul under house arrest, you get something very much like Romans 13, where the state is still a minister of God because it's exercising justice and creating civil order. By the time you get to 95 in Domitian, that same state is no longer protecting people like Paul. It's cutting his head off. Right. So Nero's the start of it, but Nero's certainly not the end of it. It really intensifies under Domitian. So I think you're describing, I think Revelation is describing conditions much later in the book of Acts.
But so you would concede there was persecution of the church by Nero?
No, I think the book of Acts is talking about Jews persecuting.
Did the Jews make use of the Roman authorities at all?
No, Paul appeals to Roman authority.
Is he ever persecuted by the Roman authorities?
Well, Paul ends up in Ephesus where he's up against the state who want him to knock off his actions because of the riot that breaks out in Ephesians. But even there, Rome is concerned not with arresting Paul and killing Christians. Rome's concerned about keeping the merchants happy and keeping the peace. That's what Rome's always concerned about. They were concerned about that during the crucifixion of Christ and Holy Week. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that argument holds any merit at all. The conditions described in Revelation are much different than earlier in the New Testament. That's why I'm of the opinion that every book in the New Testament is written before 70 except Revelation. Okay. So it's a probability case, which is more likely. And the better early date guys are the English scholars, Westcott, Horton, Lightfoot. The better late date guys, I think Beale makes a great case just by showing us the structure of Revelation. I mean, the literary structure of the book itself points beyond AD 70. And then you add that to the historical circumstance, I think the case is pretty compelling that it's a much later date. Well, let's close in prayer. Our gracious God and Father, we thank you for this wonderful book of Revelation. And it's sure and certain reminder of the triumph of the Lamb, that Jesus Christ is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and that even though the beast may rage against us, we triumph in Christ, for in Him we come alive and reign with Him forever and ever. And for this we give you thanks and praise in Christ's glorious name. Amen. Now, so that concludes our four-part series on eschatology and the Antichrist. And just a reminder that next week we'll talk for Reformation weekend about the Reformation then and now, and talk about some issues at the Reformation, how they impact us today. And following that, Ken Samples will be here to talk about his book, A World of Difference. So, see you all later.